Thank you. I've always been a silver lining kind of guy, which makes me probably a little naive, but I do look for the silver lining even on the cloudiest of days. We've certainly had our share of them lately, both literally and metaphorically. This past week, in the midst of the depressing tale of the fall of the governor of New York, and the tragic, can't think of a better word for it, race and gender punches and counterpunches being thrown in a seemingly endless presidential primary, I've got a rather uplifting note on last Wednesday's op-ed page of the Boston Globe. It was a piece by the Reverend Jim Wallis, W-A-L-L-I-S, Jim Wallis, who has created something of a niche for himself in our current socio-cultural, religious, political environment as a progressive evangelical. Now, for those who think the words progressive and evangelical don't quite fit in the same sentence, Reverend Wallis does offer something to think about. He is the founder and editor of Sojourners Magazine, which is the primary outlet for his viewpoints, and he's written several books in this genre, the latest being the one I picked up this past week, put it over here, called The Great Awakening. Wallace's Globe piece was about his recent appearance at Boston's Park Street Church, and his appearance at the Park Street Church, which is a stop on a book tour for this book of his, after noting that it was at the same somewhat theologically conservative Park Street Church that William Lloyd Garrison delivered a speech that helped to launch the abolitionist movement in the pre-Civil War era, Wallis went on to say this about his own appearance there. "I faced a packed church of hundreds of 20-something evangelicals who want to be a new generation of new abolitionists, focusing on the most vulnerable people in our world today. They suspect that Jesus would more likely care about the 30,000 children who die globally each day due to poverty and disease than he might worry about gay marriage amendments in Ohio. These young evangelicals are part of a broader, new, and spiritually rooted movement that includes the religions from many traditions and secular youth who hunger for a moral dimension to public life." At a later point in his piece, Jim Wallis adds this: "On the road, I also met a new generation of Catholics who are discovering their own church's teachings about the common good, as well as seminary students in mainline Protestant seminaries forming Beatitude Societies to study the core teachings of Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. These new abolitionists, as Wallis calls them in his latest book, are, as he points out, primarily young people seeking to abolish such social maladies as poverty, hunger, disease, environmental degradation, and more, and all in the name of Jesus and in accordance with his teachings." In fact, the subtitle of this book, you can probably see the Great Awakening part, I don't know if you can read the subtitle or not, but it says, "Reviving Faith in Politics in a Post-Religious Right America." Well, I think, I ponder on all of this. I'm no longer, by any stretch, a young person, but I've not forgotten youthful idealism and optimism of my own 20-something mainline Protestant seminary days, where, even in the midst of war and assassinations, my classmates and I seriously and hopefully explored how, in the name of faith, we might help to heal a broken world. I hope I have at least some of that idealism still left to work with today and to sustain me. I have to wonder, too, if Reverend Wallis is being a bit overly optimistic when he says that we are now in a post-religious right America. But I guess a case can be made that we're at least moving in that direction, John McCain, for example, doesn't appear to be losing a whole lot of sleep over the fact that he's not quite passing muster with James Dobson and the Focus on the Family crowd. But the thing that intrigues me the most about all of this is how Jim Wallace and his compatriots focus so intently upon the person, the life, and the teachings of Jesus as a central motivating force and inspiration in their modern-day abolitionist efforts and causes, and in their determining what's important and what isn't when it comes to where and how they choose to devote their energies. In an example, in an interview with Mother Jones Magazine, for example, and relating something I quoted a minute ago, Wallace points out that there are exactly 12 scattered verses in the entire Bible that deal with homosexuality, not one of which is found in the teachings of Jesus, while there are thousands of Bible verses, scores of which are found in the teachings of Jesus, that cry out against and decry poverty, hunger, and want. For Wallace and his fellow neo-abolitionists, then, it all eventually comes back to Jesus. Well, I think on all of this, too. And I wonder if there's something we Unitarian Universalists might be missing here. To move into our own history for a moment, the origins of our twin faith traditions of Unitarianism and Universalism, those origins lie not in a rejection of Jesus, but rather our origins lie in an attempt. Actually, it was a series of attempts and searches to redefine or reconsider or find some kind of alternative understanding of the life and ministry of Jesus that challenged the more orthodox Calvinist doctrines about who and what Jesus was. That's how we really got started. And with some notable exceptions, I would have to say that we Unitarian Universalists, by and large, we kind of almost abandoned that search for an alternative Jesus over the past half century or more. And I've come to the conclusion that this near abandonment on our part was a mistake. I'll leave that hanging for a minute and come back to it later. I'm going to move now to my second author, my second religious and spiritual thinker for this morning, and that would be Deepak Chopra and a book he just got out called The Third Jesus. All right. Move Wallace here, put Chopra up here. For those of you who are scoring this game at home, Wallace just hit a solid single. Deepak Chopra is at the plate. Baseball season can't start quickly enough for me. Yeah, all right. Well, all right. In contrast to Reverend Wallace, Dr. Chopra's religious background and identity is Hindu rather than Christian. Originally, he is an Indian medical doctor. He still is an MD. And his interest in some of the spiritual dimensions of healthcare and healing led to kind of a second career for him as a teacher and writer in contemporary spirituality, cosmology, and the New Thought movement. He's got about 50 books and essays to his credit, this being his latest one. I'm just going to give it a flyby for now, since I haven't quite finished it myself, but I got enough out of it to get a sense of where he was going. And since I read from Wallace a few minutes earlier, I'm going to do the same for Chopra. This is from the opening paragraphs of his book. He's not quite as optimistic as Wallace about the decline of the religious right, as you'll see. Jesus is in trouble. When people worship him today, or even speak his name, the object of their devotion is unlikely to be who they think he is. The legacy of love found in the New Testament has been tainted with the worst sort of intolerance and prejudice that would have appalled Jesus in his life. Most troubling of all, his teachings have been hijacked by people who hate in the name of love. A cloud of confusion hangs over the message of Jesus. Then he goes on, one Jesus is historical, and we know next to nothing about it. Another Jesus is the one appropriated by Christianity, by the church, to fulfill its agenda. The third Jesus, the one this book is about, is as yet so unknown that even the most devout Christians don't suspect he exists, yet he is the Christ we cannot and must not ignore. Close quote. We've got two different perspectives. While Wallace offers an image of Jesus as a call to work for social justice, Chopra offers an image of Jesus who is a guide to the inner life and to the attainment of what he, Chopra, calls God consciousness. Now, they're two different images. They're not mutually exclusive. They can actually complement one another because they speak to two very important pieces of our humanity. One being a need for some kind of personal peace, some kind of personal reconciliation within ourselves, within our hearts and minds, and our desire to live in a sane, just, and peaceful world. It is how Chopra gets his book title that I'm going to focus on for a few minutes, because it reiterates actually some of what I have said in my previous Palm Sunday Jesus sermons. On that note, I'm going to take a time out here for just a moment for people who maybe are fairly new to this setting to say that one of my self-created sermonic traditions is to offer on every Palm Sunday the latest rendition of my take on the life and ministry of Jesus. I've been doing this for quite a number of years now. Then one of my more recent sermonic traditions that I threw in here, as those of you who were here last Sunday may have witnessed, is to use the Sunday prior to Jack Kerouac's birthday to do a sermon on the life and the work of one of the Beat Generation writers. Now this year, with the calendar kind of working the way it did, these dual traditions happen to converge in such a way that you got back-to-back sermons. You're getting back-to-back sermons on William S. Burroughs and Jesus. I am nothing if not versatile. Anyway, back to the subject at hand, and to Dr. Chopra. The first Jesus, as he points out, is the shadowy, quasi-historical person of Jesus of Nazareth, who has been forever lost when it comes to any concrete historical and biographical inquiry into his life, particularly when it comes to how we understand history and biography in the modern era in which we live. Somebody, most likely, was there. We just don't know exactly who. Persons from Thomas Jefferson, with his humanized version of the Gospels that he called The Life and Morals of Jesus of Nazareth, to Albert Schweitzer's quest for the historical Jesus, to the learned New Testament scholars who took part in the Jesus seminar some years back, all of these folk, and many others, have tried, with degrees of both success and failure, to find the historical Jesus without ever really completely and fully uncovering it. All right, that's Jesus one, as far as Chopra is concerned. The second Jesus, to stay with his characterization, is the mythological and theological figure the first, second, and third century Christian church created and shaped out of this shadowy historical figure as they transformed the teacher Jesus into the only begotten Son of God, whose death by execution saved humanity. Now, by mythological, I don't mean false. I don't mean entirely false, anyway. For the life story and the teachings of the first Jesus got so woven together into the fabric of the second Jesus that it's practically impossible to go back and pull the two apart. So what then has come out of this interweave is an image. An image that is an amalgam of history and legend and myth. And an image that has stood as one of the central figures in the Western world for nearly the past 2,000 years, and which has attained a certain level of visibility in the Eastern world as well. It is an image that a progressive Christian evangelical like Jim Wallace and a Hindu medical doctor and philosopher like Deepak Chopra both draw inspiration and insight and guidance from. Chopra's third Jesus, which I am not going to pursue in any depth today, that's already hinted at, is essentially that of a spirit guide. What he does in his book is to take some of the stories from the life of Jesus with their acknowledged mixture of history, legend, and myth, along with some of his teachings, and then uses them to set forth a spiritual practice and a spiritual discipline that one can undertake for a sense of achieving a greater sense of personal fulfillment, personal enlightenment, and a sense of connection with the cosmos, which Chopra calls God consciousness. All right, we're going to put, if you can stand the baseball analogy one more time. Chopra hits a solid single, Wallace goes to third. On that note, I am not playing this metaphor anymore, putting them both in the dugout here. Except, yeah, and you can continue to play this game as you like. I gotta move on here. But I am gonna play off of Chopra's setup here for just a moment by saying, by saying that there's more than one way, more than one way to have a third Jesus. He provides one particular example of that. It's a good example. It's not the only possible one out there. And I think I would have to gently take issue with his assertion that in the third Jesus he offers is a Christ who cannot be ignored. But, as I say, he does offer an example of how the image and the person of Jesus can be approached and related to in a variety of ways. And on that note, picking up on a thread I left hanging out there a little while ago, I'm going to see if I can move some of this to where we happen to live. Where we live, that is to say, in this congregation and within an ongoing faith tradition called Unitarian Universalism. As I said several minutes ago, our religious forebears in this tradition of ours, if you look at it, they also were seeking their own version or versions of a third Jesus practically from the get-go, Jefferson being one of many. It was their searches, in fact, for their own third Jesus that helped to jumpstart both Unitarianism and Universalism. And to pick up on the observation and the question I posed earlier, we, in the UU faith tradition, I think we more or less let that search for our own third Jesus dissipate over the past half century or more. And that raises the question, two questions. One, was that such a good idea? And two, should we, in some measure at least, take up that search again? Well, my quick answers are no and yes. I'm going to devote the remainder of my time here to try to expand on that a little bit. I know very well that we Unitarian Universalists, and I have no desire to do this myself, I know we cannot return to the faith of our founders and become a more or less liberalized version of Christianity exclusively in the manner that a number of mainline Protestant denominations have now become. Not something I would advocate. I believe that we did go, as a movement, I believe we did go in the right direction over the course of the 20th century in affirming that there are many roads to truth, that there are many roads to spiritual nurture, and there are many good and worthy motivations one can follow when it comes to working for the common good and standing for a more just and sane world. But I also believe, especially when it comes to the religious education of our children, that the image, the person, the moral example of Jesus should be a visible part of a larger mix. For the Jesus image and example can be a road, should be a road, not the road, to be sure, but one of the roads we can point to when it comes to seeking truth and seeking after justice. And this actually gets me, if you can handle one more, to my third book of the morning, this one being a children's book called Meet Jesus, published by our Unitarian, just out, published by our Unitarian Universalist Association Skinner House Press. Subtitle of this one is The Life and Lessons of a Beloved Teacher. I borrowed this copy off the shelf in Chris Parker's religious education office, and I borrowed its title for my sermon title for today. I'm not sure just where this particular book gets used in our overall religious education curriculum, but I like the way it's written. It does tell the Jesus story in a clear and positive ways, in ways that you could certainly use in the way we do religious education here. Since I've read from the other two, I'll pull out a couple of passages from this one. This is the story of Jesus, a beloved teacher. Although he lived long ago, his lessons of love and kindness still bring hope and joy to people all over the world. And then it moves through the accounts of his life and his teachings with such passages as, Jesus taught his followers to look for ways to live together in harmony, to learn to forgive, and to settle arguments in a peaceful way. Blessed are those who work to bring peace to the world, he said, for they are the children of God. It does deal with his death, saying he was killed by Roman authorities for, quote, stirring up trouble, as the text puts it, which is quite true. There's nothing in here about him having to die for the sins of humanity. Instead, it moves to this ending. After Jesus died, his followers carried on his teachings and honored his memory. Jesus' message of love and kindness spread throughout the world. Now, 2,000 years later, we can still learn from the life and lessons of Jesus. Some people say that Jesus was the Son of God. They say that after Jesus died, God resurrected or brought him back to life. They celebrate his resurrection on Easter Sunday. Some people say that Jesus was a wise and beloved teacher, whether or not he was the Son of God. They say it is important to remember him because he taught us to treat people with love and to stand up for justice and peace. And it ends on this note. We celebrate the life of Jesus by trying to live as he did, with full hearts, loving words, and kind actions. So that's my third word for it today. Well, it's a children's book, written in children's language. But I have to say I am glad that our association has put it out for reasons that go beyond its being a children's book. I go back to that passage from Jim Wallace's piece in The Globe, where he makes the reference to, quote, secular youth who hunger for a moral dimension to life, to public life. While agreeing with Wallace, I would go on to say that one need not be a secular youth to hunger for a moral dimension to public life. I think we all look for that and want that. One of those mistakes that I was referring to earlier, I think Unitarian Universalists made in moving away from our own upholding of the person and image of Jesus as an exemplar of religious liberalism, is that we left the field a little too open for those who would define that moral dimension to public life in very narrow and moralistic and self-righteous ways, so that we do get a situation that Dr. Chopra quite correctly described as being one in which Jesus' teachings have been hijacked by people who hate in the name of love. I think what you use also erred in equating an embrace of humanism, an embrace I have made myself, an embrace of humanism with a dismissal or a diminishment of the Jesus story, when the two can actually be quite compatible. I will readily grant, this is why I would take issue with Chopra's thing about a crisis that cannot be ignored, I would readily grant that a person does not need the image and example and guidance of Jesus, whoever he may have been, when it comes to pursuing the moral and ethical life, for being an advocate for peace and justice, and for following a meaningful spiritual path. Human beings, I am sure, would still be pursuing these things, both quite well and quite poorly, had Jesus never lived at all or ever been heard of. But the larger point, it seems to me, is that He did live. However much his life is shrouded in mystery and myth and legend. And he did, as I've already said, leave an image and a story that remains one of the core images, one of the core stories of our increasingly multifaceted civilization and world. The simply written children's book, whose brief passages I just shared, is one example of how we keep that story alive and meaningful within our Unitarian Universalist family, along with the other stories, the other paths that we honor and that we celebrate. And so as our Christian friends, our Christian sisters and brothers, approach the most sacred week now on the Christian calendar, let us also be mindful within our life, within our lives, and within our faith tradition of the ways in which this story can also touch and inform our lives as well. On that note, let's sing together our closing hymn.